The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service, intended for people who are blind and print impaired. It's Indie Week, and I'm John Feddersen here to read it at you. And this is the issue dated March the 8th of 2024, which is a Friday. And why am I mentioning that? Because on Sunday, March the 10th, by the time you wake up, your clocks should be set ahead 1 hour, 1 hour ahead for daylight savings time, which begins on Sunday at 2 a.m. So we probably have some few robots that set everything, but there might be a little alarm clock that you might want to take a note of. And let's remember to do that, because heaven forbid that you miss an hour of something. All right, let's get to our issue of Indie Week. Well, we're often careful to remind folks that it's the print edition is subservient now to the online edition of Indie Week, which is indieweek.com. And a couple things, you can find past issues, past articles that may interest you. After long periods of time, they're stored, and also later breaking things which would not have made it into the print edition. And the first one of these, I'm looking online at indieweek.com to say for the second time in 2 months, a Raleigh City Council member brought forth an action for a vote that came as a surprise to other council members. At the end of the regular meeting, Tuesday afternoon, District A Council Member Mary Black introduced a Gaza ceasefire resolution with the intention of putting it forth for a vote. Mayor Marianne Baldwin said during a meeting last month the Raleigh City Council hadn't come to a consensus on a ceasefire resolution and would not vote on one. Instead, she read a statement from the council. She said, quote, "Our community is conflicted, but our values are evident. We call for the protection of all civilians and humanitarian relief. We call for the safe return of all hostages. We, like many others in our country, call on world leaders to work toward an end to this conflict and a peaceful, long-term solution. We call for peace at home and abroad." But some council members had been working on a draft of a ceasefire resolution in response to demands from hundreds of community activists who have been attending city council meetings for months. At the beginning of Tuesday's meetings, council members were handed a copy of the draft of that resolution, or a similar version, with the expectation it would be brought forth for a vote. Black introduced the resolution after reading a passage from Angela Davis's Freedom is a Constant Struggle. Still, Baldwin made a motion for the council to proceed to vote on the resolution. The motion passed unanimously. Then the council voted on whether to adopt the ceasefire resolution, which resulted in a 4-4 failed vote. Council members Jane Harrison, Corey Branch, each reiterated some of the sentiments from the original statement calling for peace. Branch, who voted against adopting that ceasefire resolution, said there is wording in the draft resolution he would have wanted to change. But Black said, "I just want to say I'm proud of us for getting here." She, Harrison, and council members Megan Patton and Christina Jones voted in favor. "It's been a long journey," she continued. "One way or another, our voices and votes need to be apparent for the people in the community, one side or the other. And now that's clear." And the second of these late-breaking online stories comes from Durham, and it was written at least this morning, or put on this morning. On Monday night, Durham City Council voted 4-2 against signing a new contract for the gunfire detection technology called ShotSpotter. The vote comes after the City Council received a presentation at its February 22nd work session from researchers at Wilson Center for Science and Justice at Duke University Law School on their analysis of the data from that 12-month pilot conducted last year. And the data showed a reduction in response times to gunshot incidents in the pilot's 3-square-mile area. But Wilson Center's report indicated it couldn't draw conclusions as to whether ShotSpotter had a meaningful impact on reducing gun violence. 20 Durham residents, including three who identified themselves as living in the pilot area, spoke for roughly an hour. During the public hearing, folks drew connections between over-policing and the conflict in Gaza and voiced their concerns around spending city funds on, quote, surveillance technology instead of other resources like the HEART program to help reduce systemic harms in the community. Durham resident Quisha Millett said ShotSpotter has promoted more violence against East Durham residents through policing of black and brown bodies during times when no one called 9/11. Tara Felice, an East Durham resident who recently published an op-ed opposing ShotSpotter in the Indy, said the city should prioritize community safety initiatives such as installing sidewalks and better lighting city parks over ShotSpotter. Quote, there is a higher priority on policing communities than there is on funding things that are left to the participatory budget to cover. King Sage, who also lives in that pilot area, echoed those sentiments. I never once heard my neighbors seriously say that we needed more policing and surveillance. Wilma Oliver, a City of Durham employee who lives in the ShotSpotter pilot area, was the lone community member who spoke in favor, saying, my hope is for the law-abiding citizen to look at it as a let's take this multi-pronged approach. We're not asking ShotSpotter to be the spear that solves the problem. I'm saying let it be one of the tines of the fork to help address this gun violence. Along with its report evaluating ShotSpotter's effectiveness, researchers at Wilson Center spoke with 30 residents of the pilot area about their experiences living in the community, interactions with police, experience with gun violence, and the feelings about ShotSpotter more broadly. The conversations with the residents, says Wilson Center, revealed nuanced opinions on the role of police officers, the ethics of technology in policing, and the importance of community engagement and transparency in policy making. Less often did these conversations reveal any observed changes in their neighborhoods after ShotSpotter was implemented. On the positive side, this means that residents generally did not observe negative outcomes that some other cities experienced, such as over-policing. Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton, along with Mayor Leonardo Williams, was one of those in favor of extending that contract. Middleton said, no one ever said that ShotSpotter was going to reduce gun violence. That argument was created and then refuted as part of the discussion. What was said is that we could reduce response time. What was said is that getting to gunfire faster is important. What was said is that knowing precisely where it's coming from in our streets is not a threat to our democracy. Middleton made the case that reducing gun violence is not an outcome of ShotSpotters, that proponents of the technology, including sound thinking, originally pitched. But Councilmember Javier Caballero, who was appointed to City Council in 2018 and reelected last year, says she remembers the initial conversation differently. She read a statement from sound thinking representatives to the audience that was delivered to the City Council in 2019. When the pilot was first under consideration. The proposal read, we are committed to developing comprehensive, respectful, and intimate partnerships with agencies and their respective cities, organized around making a positive difference. Today, ShotSpotter is highly regarded as a critical component of a comprehensive gun violence reduction strategy. The statement illustrates a change in attitude that Caballero says shifts the goalposts on the rhetoric used to present ShotSpotters. While she and other council members agree, some of the data in Wilson Center report shows a positive aspect on things like response times. The technology is not solving the core problem of reducing gun violence. Caballero said, I will not argue the data. But to change the argument around your tool so you can sell it better is dishonest and not fact-based. She, along with Councilmembers Nate Baker, Chelsea Cook, and Carl Rist, voted against extending the contract. Deidreana Freeman had an excused absence from the meeting and missed the vote. ShotSpotter might not be moving forward in Durham, but the money for the contract extension has already been allocated in the fiscal budget, said City Manager Wanda Page during the meeting. The council could choose to follow the wishes of some in the community and reallocate the funds to other public safety programs like the HART program. And that concludes that update, that article. Oh, except to add that the city will host a first public hearing for the 24-25 fiscal budget. That's coming up on March 18th, public hearing. Last year, residents who spoke at that meeting advocated for expansion of the HART program and the hiring of a Vision Zero coordinator. Both items were included in this budget, in the 23-24 budget. Now, we'll get to some election, primary election returns or results in a moment. First, another column about Durham and the Mangum and Roxborough Streets resurfacing project. Chris Perlstein needed to take his two dogs, and Castillo and Luna, outside one last time before calling it a night. He moved from Raleigh to Durham with his wife nearly a year ago. As he stepped out onto the patch of grass in front of his townhouse, a speeding car came barreling down Roxborough Street, jumped the curb, and nearly collided with Perlstein and his dog, Luna. He said, "I think that was the first thing where we got really rattled by unsafe conditions, especially on the road we live on." Perlstein, a computer programmer, decided to use his skills for tracking vehicle speeds on the section of Roxborough Street in front of his house. He uses a camera and a Raspberry Pi, a small single-board computer, to capture photos of vehicles traveling at 55 miles per hour or faster. That's 20 miles over the 35-mile-an-hour speed limit. These photos are automatically posted to X, formerly Twitter, under the account of @RecklessRoxborough. Perlstein hopes the account grabs the attention of folks in the community as well as the City of Durham's Transportation Department and North Carolina's Department of Transportation, DOT. "I did go through a period," he says, "where I was at NCDOTing. Turns out that counts as spamming them if you don't provide some method for them to unsubscribe, which I find ironic because I can't unsubscribe from their unsafe road, right? I briefly got banned by Twitter for that." Residents will have the chance to share their concerns about pedestrian safety with Durham City staff at the first of three upcoming open houses regarding the resurfacing of Roxborough and Mangum Street. The first meeting takes place on March the 12th at the Global Scholars Academy. Resurfacing is often used as a cost-effective way for local governments to make on-street design improvements. Adding features like bike lanes and crosswalks is cheaper because the paint and other materials are already budgeted for. Sean Egan, Durham Transportation Director, told Indy back in October, "Each one of those projects has funding already allocated to put down new pavement markings. So if we do some of that concept development and community engagement around what changes in design, we basically get all the construction costs for free." Making significant changes to state-owned roads can be a difficult task, as advocates found out in September when a communication breakdown between Durham DOT and NC DOT led Durham's Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Commission, BPAC, to write an open letter to city and state officials criticizing NC DOT's decision to halt infrastructure improvements on Fayetteville Street near NC 147. BPAC member Mary Rose Fontana told Indy last fall, "I don't even look for places to go on Fayetteville Street knowing we're not going to drive there because it's not safe. It's a deterrent for people who don't want to risk their safety." Residents and business owners in Roxborough Mangum Project footprint echo concerns about safety in their neighborhood. Exorbitant speeds on those streets are not uncommon, according to data that Perelstein has collected over the past several months, saying, we generally have about 250 reckless speeders a day. Some days it's upwards of 350 to 400. Some days it's down at like 150. It varies. State law marks reckless driving at 15 miles per hour over the designated speed limit. On Roxborough, the speed limit is 35. Perelstein says because of Twitter only allows him to send 50 automated tweets a day for free, he has had to raise the speed limit of cars he tweeted pictures from 50 to 59 miles per hour. Otherwise, there would be too many speeding vehicles for the account to post. Mangum Street has seen a resurgence of activity in the last year. New apartments and condos have popped up, and new businesses have taken root in old Five Points. But the precarity, this is the first time I've seen that word, precarity of walking down the block, says Lindsay Andrews, owner of Night School Bar on North Mangum, is a deterrent for potential customers. Quote, you don't see much foot traffic, even though there are people in the neighborhoods all around. I think having a street that feels safer to walk up and down with more greenery and bike lanes would really increase foot traffic, which would be nice for the businesses. Andrews lives in the neighborhood. She opened Night School Bar last October and frequently walks to work. Soon after signing the lease for the new business, Andrews says a vehicle crashed into the storefront next door. Last week, the driver of a passenger van and an officer driving a Durham police car were involved in a crash at the intersection of Mangum and Morris that sent the police car into the facade of the Indian Monsoon. These kinds of violent collisions are scary and make would-be pedestrians feel unsafe. Marcus Morrow, neighborhood resident and co-owner of Chibanga's Neighborhood Market on North Mangum, says it's very difficult to promote people walking downtown. Chibanga's and Everloo, the neighboring coffee shop, offer customers outdoor seating on the storefront patio, but access to the space and constant noise pollution from traffic on the street make hanging out at the business a tough sell. Morrow says more people walking is great from a business perspective, but not when they're terrified getting hit by a car. Earlier this month, residents and local officials gathered at the downtown Durham bus station to discuss the future of local transit in the region. City and county staff members shared budget overviews and details on specific initiatives that the transportation departments are investing in to make public transit safer and more accessible. That seems a little bit unrelated to the problem of getting hit by a car. But that concludes that particular article. All right, last week's issue of Indy Week gave us some election results, or preliminary election results. I have Wake County and Orange County here in this current issue. On Super Tuesday, Orange County progressives narrowly won a majority on the school board, according to unofficial results. Incumbents Kerry Doyle and Jennifer Moore successfully defended their seats with roughly 18.5% and 16.5% of votes cast in an election where voters could pick three candidates. Newcomer Wendy Padilla won a first term with almost 17%. All three winners are Democrats. By winning all three seats, the progressive slate edged out moderate incumbent Bonnie Hauser, also a Democrat, who came in fourth with 15.3%. With Sarah Smiley, who was not up for re-election, the progressive bloc will have a 4-3 majority on the board. That marks a step to the left in northern Orange County, a politically mixed district that, since 2016, has been caught in culture wars surrounding the Confederate flag, COVID, and LGBTQ books in schools. Doyle, the top vote-getter, says the progressive slate was really the student-centered slate, and that's what people want for their kids. People understood that centering kids and well-being and trying to serve kids in an equitable way is also better for kids academically. This was the first election since the current board controlled by a coalition of moderates and conservatives, pushed out Superintendent Monique Fielder in August. This spring, the moderate to conservative slate argued voters should choose the kids over politics, a message that Doyle pushed back against, arguing her opponents were creating a, quote, false choice between equity policies and student performance. Doyle and her allies were backed by Communities Supporting Orange County Schools, that's a new PAC, as well as former school board member Hillary McKenzie and former Hillsborough Mayor Jen Weaver. Friends of Orange County Schools PAC, funded by former board members Stephen and Susan Halkiotis, backed Hauser as well as first-time candidates Cindy Schreiner and Michael Johnson, both unaffiliated, who won 14.6 and 13.5% of votes cast, respectively. Kevin Alston Jr., a first-time progressive candidate who was not associated with either slate, won 4.4% of the vote. Now, in the Democratic primary election for Orange County Commissioner, incumbent Phyllis Porte-Ascott trounced her challenges with 72% of the vote. She was appointed by the County Commission in 2023 to represent District 2 and is seeking a full term. Horace Johnson took 18% of the vote and Adam Beeman got 6.7. A real estate agent and former chair of the Northern Orange Black Voters Alliance, Porte-Ascott will face Republican nominee H. Nathan Robinson in November's general election. She said in a candidate forum last February, "My journey has allowed me to build lasting relationships across Orange County, whether it's working with the Northern Orange NAACP, supporting our public schools, or advocating for equity." Porte-Ascott also defended the commission's decision to place a $300 million bond referendum on the ballot this coming November. Johnson had argued the resultant tax increase would price out residents who are already suffering from the impact of gentrification. If voters approve, the money will be used to improve facilities in both Orange County and Carrboro-Chapel Hill school districts. Porte-Ascott wrote to the Indy questionnaire, "The tension between adequately funding capital needs and looking out for our vulnerable citizens will always be why I listen the hardest and discern the deepest." I'm moving right along to Wake County election results. District Court 10 will see new judges, and Tara Waters wins a Democratic primary in the county commissioner's race. District Court 10 will likely see at least four new judges on the bench next year as challengers defeated two sitting judges and two judges retired, paving the way for newcomers, according to unofficial election results that the North Carolina Board of Elections posted Wednesday morning. At the county's District Court Democratic primary, challenger Renee Jordan, an attorney who defends clients charged with felonies, misdemeanors, DWIs, and traffic violations, looks to have defeated incumbent Judge Anna Worley, who has served in the District 10C, seat 3 spot, since 2009. Jordan took 51% of the vote to Worley's 49. And in the District Court 10E, seat 3, Crystal Grimes, a public defender, defeated 17-year incumbent Judge Eric Chass, with Grimes taking 72% of the vote to Chass's 28. In the race to fill retiring Judge Deborah Sasser's 10D, seat 5, Wake County Clerk of Superior Court Blair Williams defeated challenger Kevin Boxberger, a criminal defense attorney, with 59% of the vote. But after Wake County District Court 10, Chief Justice Ned Mangum retired last month, leaving his 10D seat 3 spot open. The Wake County Democratic Party nominated Boxberger to run for that seat. Boxberger told the Indy he plans to do so in November and will face Republican Carl Roth in that race. And in District 10A seat 3, incumbent Judge Cindy Kenney defended her seat against criminal defense attorney and Wake County Assistant DA Douglas Brown, taking 71% to Brown's 29%. In the Democratic primary race for the Wake County Board of Commissioners District 5 seat, former Wake County Public School Board of Education member Tara Waters defeated Daquanta Copeland, a community activist who ran for Raleigh mayor in 2022. Waters, an educator, was appointed to that seat in January following the death of County Commissioner James West last November. In the Republican primary race for Wake County Board of Commissioners District 6 seat, attorney Jacob Arthur defeated Darren Eustace with 80% of the vote. Eustace actually dropped out of the race, but his name still appeared on the ballot. So Arthur will run against sitting Democratic County Commissioner Shanika Thomas in November. The sitting Wake County School Board member Monica Johnston Hostler, the executive director of a nonprofit that works to end domestic violence and sexual assault, will take a seat in the North Carolina House of Representatives. Johnston Hostler won a three-way race in NC House District 33, taking 60% of the vote against challengers Antoine Marshall and Deborah Dunstan, who took 26 and 14%. Johnston Hostler has no Republican challenger in November. In Senate District 34, longtime State Senator Dan Blue easily defended his seat with about 86% of the vote. In the Republican primaries, attorney Mike Scheitzelt defeated James Norman in House District 35, taking 65% of the vote. He will run against Yvonne Hopkins, a family law attorney. And in Senate District 13, public school teacher Scott Lassiter defeated Vicky Harry with 53% of the vote. He will run against Democratic State Senator Lisa Grafstein, a civil rights attorney, in November. And Congresswoman Deborah Ross easily overcame a challenge from Michael Camaro, taking 93% of the vote in the solidly blue U.S. House District 2. And she'll run against Republican Alan Swain, who defeated two opponents with 60% of the vote in November. Who cast ballots in Wake County primary? About 25% of the electorate. And you can see all of these results and for more, including Durham, still back on IndyWeek.com. Well, let's talk about fitness now. A specific type of fitness, specifically walking across the United States. Holden Minor Ringer is a man walking across the U.S., but he doesn't particularly want to be called the walking man. He doesn't want to talk about how many pairs of shoes he goes through in the last year, and he definitely does not want to hear your crappy Forrest Gump jokes. "I don't want to be pigeonholed into one thing," says the man who is more than 340 days into a walk across the country. But Ringer is a nice guy, and he knows we're only human and can't resist asking questions and making jokes, so if you do indulge, he'll answer with a smile. On February 20th, day 333 of this walk from Washington State to Washington, D.C., the 26-year-old walked into the Bull City, headed east on Chapel Hill Street and pushing a stroller full of travel essentials. Having grown up in Dallas and graduated from Emory University in Georgia, being back in the South is a bit of a homecoming. Ringer tells me, it's the worst region in the entire country to walk through, perhaps affectionately, as we walk around Durham's downtown. His journey across the country is partly to promote pedestrian safety and partly because he thought it would be a cool thing to do. Along the way, he's met local advocates and strangers alike. He's a strange person with a strange hobby, but would rather talk about his reason for walking, rattling off relevant statistics like 44,000 people die in car crashes every single year. The idea for his trek, which has taken him on a curving path from Washington State down to Atlanta, then rounding northeast through Durham, came to him when he was about to graduate college in 2021 and feeling the stress of final exams. Quote, as a form of procrastination, I started Googling walking across America, and the seeds were just planted. In 2023, he started the walk. He mostly walks alone, accompanied only by his stroller, Smiley. That's a storage unit for sustenance, like water, lots of canned pears, shelter, a tent, and other essentials, books. Smiley is also a companion, in keeping with that Tom Hanks theme, maybe in the mold of Castaway's Wilson. But the stroller is also a reminder to keep finding a reason to smile, even in hard stretches, like struggling across the high plains out west. He says, you're staring at thousands of miles of sagebrush. Meanwhile, I was good at getting over a breakup at the same time, and it's like you're seeing your ex in all the sagebrush. If you take one takeaway from meeting me, it's America is not a walking place. And there's lots of generous people in America. Walkability, as it turns out, is not just about sidewalks. It's like, he says, where do I go to the bathroom? Where do I sit down at a bus stop? How close is a grocery store to my house? He spends a lot of time walking on highway shoulders, and lots of the people he sees there aren't exactly doing it for fun. He says, oftentimes it's poor folks that may not have any other option. Departments of transportation across the country see those people as invisible. He's also walked past a lot of roadside memorials, often large crosses marking the spot where someone was killed by a careless driver. These deaths, he says, are preventable. Quote, I can see a driver on their phone, you know, from hundreds of meters away, and it's like, I can tell they're on their phone before I even see the phone. That's the scariest thing I deal with. Ringer points out that in the South, much of the infrastructure was built during the post-war era of the automobile. That's the case in Durham, where downtown revitalization plans led to the creation of pairs of two-lane, one-way streets like Duke, Gregson, and Roxborough, and Mangum. That design leads to increased driving speeds and thus higher danger for pedestrians. While in the city, Ringer met with Bike Durham advocates, currently campaigning for changes to Roxborough and Mangum streets. You may recall the article I just read. The speed limit on that parallel pair of north-south streets is 35 miles an hour. Though a resident-run Twitter account, Reckless Roxborough, regularly posts photos of cars going faster than 60 miles an hour in the residential stretch. While in Durham, Ringer visited Roxborough and took some videos for Bike Durham to demonstrate how unsafe it is. Over the journey, Ringer has also dealt with the oddity of becoming a minor internet sensation. Headlines like, Emory University's alum's epic journey, and wow, man attempting to walk across country, appear like footprints behind him. He also keeps a blog and posts on Reddit, platforms that help him plan ahead and make inroads for his next stop. In his five nights in Durham, for instance, he scored a free night at the Durham Hotel, saying, probably the nicest hotel that anyone has ever gifted me. And then four nights with some kind-hearted Bike Durham advocates. When he can't find someone to host him through Reddit or asking around, he'll pitch his tent in a yard or a church. As Ringer walked around Durham, he shared stories about parking minimums in Greensboro, a preacher in Gaffney, South Carolina, and accidentally herding goats near Winston-Salem. In return, Durham residents shared tales of the pedestrian nightmare of the loop, the rise of one city center, and the Ellerbee Creek Trail dinosaur. On day 338, Ringer walked north on Roxborough Street headed toward Oxford, taking those Bull City stories with him. His walk officially ends in D.C., but he plans to walk up to New York and see the Atlantic. By May, he'll make it to New Haven, Connecticut, where his grandparents are memorialized. On day 339, having moved on toward Virginia, he posted, "Leaving Durham yesterday, I felt some real sadness. From the very first interaction I had with folks in town, I felt a sense of warmth and community so prevalent that remained throughout my stay in Bull City. So thank you, Durham. You're special, and I hope to return one day." Well, and yet another interesting article concerning fitness a bit, the outdoors and another bit, and it's about the indoor climbing industry is booming, but the transition has changed the sport of rock climbing. Of all people, it was a jiu-jitsu partner who asked Bryce Mahoney if he wanted to go on an outdoor climbing excursion to Pilot Mountain. Mahoney said, "Sure, why not?" The agreement required him to trust his friend's expertise that everything was safe, but at the time he didn't know how much peace and restoration the activity would bring to him. He didn't know how much it would click, being so high up off the ground. Mahoney, who now climbs several days a week and is active in climber organizations, said he finds connection with a variety of people through the hobby. It's become a wellness activity for the general public, but rock climbing didn't always enjoy such a robust community. It began as a primitive outdoor sport in the 1800s, used mainly as a means of exploration. Only hemp ropes and wooden pegs ensured daring alpinists, who often relied on their own physical strength for safety hundreds of feet above the ground. And while the feats of early adventurers are still admired around the world, the sport has changed drastically from what it once was. Climbers learned to use anchors for increased safety. Daredevils began making world news with their bold accomplishments, turning rock climbing into a global activity. In 1968, an early climbing wall opened at the University of Leeds in England as a means of controlled indoor training. The first climbing walls were less of a spectacle than they are today. Rocks taken from the outdoors were drilled to a wooden board only a few meters above the ground. From those beginnings, rock climbing, whether it's indoor or outdoor, has turned into a multi-billion dollar industry. Today's indoor climbing gyms are multifaceted organizations, often offering yoga classes, social and activity rooms, plastic rock walls, and yes, actual gyms. Philip Morgan, who's been climbing in and outdoors for 35 years, said, "It's more mainstream now. I mean, it used to be you were one of those out-of-the-edge people, say like a rugby player." At the end of 2023, a total of 785 climbing gyms were open in the United States, compared to 350 gyms in 2014. That's 122% increase in less than 10 years. The industry accumulates over $30 billion in revenue yearly, according to the Climbing Wall Association, rivaling the general fitness, health, and gym club industry, which produced about $30.6 billion in 2022, and climbing has more room to grow. Joe Graybeal, a managing partner for the Triangle Rock Club, said the ratio of people in the United States who have an indoor climbing membership relative to those who have a monthly membership to a health or fitness club is about 1 to 100. So, he says, if we as an industry just convert one more out of every 100 people that are already used to paying a monthly membership fee, we double the size of our industry. Man, that's a pretty staggering statistic. When it opened in 2007, Triangle Rock Club, known in the Raleigh-Durham area simply as TRC, was a dedicated climbing gym located in Morrisville. As indoor climbing grew, the organization's business model adapted. The original location has since expanded, garnishing its older version with a set of 55-foot climbing walls, a fitness space, yoga studio, private conference rooms, cardio machines, and Wi-Fi supplied lounge. Four more TRC sites with similar features have opened in North Carolina and Virginia since 2013. The cost of an individual membership in a TRC is $95 per month, which includes access to all the organization's rock walls in North Carolina and Virginia. The business now has thousands of members, but while commercialized climbing has provided a greater means of access to the sport, it has impacted its outdoor counterpart. Douglas Houghton, a North Carolina climber of 49 years, said, "As far as the number of people you get into issues, especially outdoors, obviously indoors, they want everybody to come. You're paying for it. Outdoors, you're dealing with land managers, and they will see the impact." And as the indoor industry expands, a growing number of thrill seekers want to take on those walls outside, aggregating this effect. For example, several rock faces, including some in western North Carolina, are closed yearly to protect peregrine falcons, previously endangered birds of prey that usually nest on tall vertical surfaces. Outdoor climbers may disturb nesting pairs who will abandon their site and not return till the following year. Houghton says, "You know, instead of 20 climbers a week showing, there are hundreds per week, and each one of those has an impact on the environment. That's something we're seeing more and more, is closures due to environmental impact. Nature is also much less controlled." Mahoney, a Northern Piedmont board representative for Carolina Climbers Coalition, said, "Rising numbers of indoor climbers transitioning outdoors could increase the number of unsafe things that can occur at any accessible cliff." Mahoney said many gyms only require climbers to know how to clip into their harnesses, as many safety practices are automated for liability purposes. Meanwhile, outdoor climbers are required to know how to build anchors, tie a variety of knots, and look for falling rocks. Outdoor rock climbing accounts for approximately 30 deaths per year. This past October, a student from University of Georgia died after falling 90 feet while climbing outside in Alabama. Another college student fell to his death while climbing in Central Oregon in July of last year. "There's not the mentorship there used to be," says Houghton. "When we started climbing, you climbed with somebody that knew what they were doing. And then nowadays, people depend on the gyms more, and I think a lot maybe aren't quite getting as much education about safety before they go outside." Despite the dangers, Mahoney said he believes there's room for less experienced people who want to learn. In partnership with Carolina Climbing Coalition, TRC is working on a pilot program to provide its members with necessary skills and mentorship for outdoor climbing. Graybeal noted that nothing learned while climbing indoors has to be unlearned when you're climbing outside. Quote, "There are many organizations like American Alpine Club that host different skill clinics at gyms like this that somewhat bridge the gap and help create a school learning experience inside a closed environment." Still, Graybeal estimates around 70% of TRC members have no desire to climb outdoors as they derive enough benefit from indoor climbing. But the sport has always been rooted in connection with others. Rock climbing gyms have made a healthy activity accessible to a large chunk of the population, says Mahoney. And while there are purists who criticize sports translation into a full-scale industry, there are positive effects. And Mahoney said, "It's one of those things that if you're shocked at this growing and expanding the way it is, you seem that you weren't really paying attention." And now my clock tells me I have about 13 minutes. I might be able to get through just about a complete book review and interview about a local author named Jill McCorkle, who released on Algonquin Books in January of this year, Old Crimes and Other Stories. This title, a short story collection called Old Crimes, hints at dramatic secrets. Some of the regrets embedded in these secrets are painful. In The Lineman, the second story in the collection, a man ruminates on his regret at cheating on his high school sweetheart, but considers the great gift of his daughter from his second rocky marriage. In the closing story, Sparrow, a town gratuitously discusses a woman's murder-suicide, only later wondering if the story isn't quite what it seems. Most of the stories are about regrets over things left undone. In the title story, a woman thinks back to a neglected child she met on a rather listless vacation with their boyfriend. In The Last Station, a woman finally expresses her regret at all the years she spent placing her family, who don't even remember her birthday, above herself. Many of the stories are set in an anonymous small town in the South, and a few have nearly recognizable North Carolina landmarks. They feel like they could be drawn from one community, but also they could take place anywhere, which is exactly what McCorkle wanted. The unifying themes, regret, selfishness, honesty, emerged as McCorkle was writing, coalescing into a collection that encompasses stories she wrote decades ago, as well as some sparked by her work on her previous book, 2020's Hieroglyphics. This retrospective attitude is one of McCorkle's favorites to write. Since her first novels in the 1980s, she's written characters looking back over their lives. She's been writing in and about the South for decades, with a few discursions to the Northeast. Occasionally from Lumberton, the Dos Passos Prize winner has spent years teaching at several universities, including UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and Harvard. Now based in Hillsboro, McCorkle recently retired from teaching creative writing at NC State, but says she plans to continue taking students at workshops and touring with Old Crimes this year. And on the heels of this release, Indy sat down with McCorkle to discuss small-town mythologies, building believable towns, and why it's so important to look back over your life. This is a sort of a question-and-answer dialogue, so I'll affect in my masterful voice two different voices. Indy, many of the stories in this collection interact, and many take place in the same town. How did you balance this consistency of voice with how unique all these characters are? Oh, thank you for that, says McCorkle. I really wanted that effect of how every microcosm is similar in a lot of ways, that you could have a very similar experience in a different place, and being a very different human. I wanted to paint portraits of fully developed people, but then show them interacting in ways and in places that have more of a universal feel. I kept coming back to something like the story Sparrow, where you've got parents gathered at a ball game. Though they may all look alike on the surface, they're not. They're bringing different stories and a lot of disagreements, but still fitting under the umbrella of one place and the history of that place. I used to do this prompt often with my classes, writing that kind of lore, the myths of a town, the stories that get told. And so often when that kind of conversation comes up, people refer to the child something happened to, or abduction stories. Those are definitely the kind of stories that paralyze a town and then become something much bigger. Next, I read in another interview you were thinking about fairy tales with this collection, which surprised me because it's definitely more on the realism side. But those stories of the kid wandering off into the forest, is that how you were thinking about fairy tales with this collection? Absolutely. I grew up reading the real fairy tales. They were meant to be moral lessons, some more extreme than others, and scary as a result. But there were lessons in the stories, and I very much see the way these children are almost turned into saints in that regard. I love the threat of fairy tales in that way, the menace. Some end happily ever after, but not as often as you would think. Oh, that's great. I was also really curious about the title, Old Crimes. Many of these stories deal with regret, but many of the main crimes were by omission rather than commission. I think growing up Protestant, I forget that's really a thing, you know? Can you dig into that a little more? Yes, I think there are times when silence is pretty dangerous. And I think a lot of our regrets in life probably do fall under that category of those times when you don't speak, don't act. Given where we are in the world, I think we're in such a place. It just bothers me any time life is made so simple that it's this easy either or, right, wrong label for a person. I find that really threatening because humans are a lot more complicated than that. It's too easy to do away with many things in that way. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of the way one person can have had a positive influence in one way and done something really terrible in life. Some of the characters there felt that way, and it was interesting to me to do that, because I don't think any human is pure. Not to immediately drop back to fairy tales, but those simplistic narratives about who is safe are often worse for us. Yes, and we're very often wrong when we form those quick judgments and first impressions. I was struck by the different ways you looked at female characters, wishing they had asserted their desires. These women who had sacrificed their whole lives and wished they'd been a little bit more selfish, I love them. I think that's unfortunately a truth, right? I was in high school in the 70s with We've Come a Long Way, Baby, a cigarette jingle, and Gloria Steinem. We'd gone from The Housewives on TV to Mary Tyler Moore, and things were looking up. They didn't keep moving at that rate. In fact, there have been some giant steps backwards. I think there are women a little older than I am, especially, who really fell into that place. I think it could be true of a man as well, that you wake up one day and have that sudden realization that years have passed, and that's a kind of regret, what you did not do or weren't able to do, like the mother in the story The Last Station out there with her cross. She's letting it all out, the years of what she felt were sacrifices. Another consistent theme was finding the right balance of honesty and selfishness. There's a perfect amount of both that will keep a relationship functioning and also protect your personhood. These balances are so specific, but you need them. Right, you do. In my last novel, Hieroglyphics, there's one character who was a dancer and taught dance, so she's always talking about balance. And in her old age, she's decided that's the magic word, balance. I tend to agree with that. You could take a big swing in either direction, but I'm always thinking, where's the bridge between the two? Where's the cog that holds the pendulum? Looking at both this book and your body of work, this posture of reflecting over the years seems like a place that you like to write from. Why is that a perspective you like so much? You know, I just think I'm really interested at how we're shaped by what has already happened, what happened early in life, oftentimes what happened to family members. As children, we hear the stories that are part of our family history about things that happened before we were born. The best part about getting older is that you really can look behind you, and so many things are as clear as if there is a map, and you begin to understand and recognize things you could never have seen in the moment. There's the wonderful opportunity to learn from ourselves that way, just by looking back and putting things in perspective. Sometimes I'll look back and think about kids I was in school with, and it'll suddenly occur to me, oh, wow, their life was so much harder. Or you learn one little detail about somebody you grew up with, their family or their situation. Suddenly the light bulbs go off, and you sort of understand everything you thought you knew in a different way, you know? There's something very satisfying in that to me. If you do live long enough, you do have the opportunity to make sense of it. Sadly, What everybody always says is, if only I could have this brain and that body. I think that's the wish. But I told an audience recently that if I had to choose, I think I would take the mind over the body. It is a tough choice some days. Depends on the day, says the questioner in her last interview. You've mentioned before you pull details from your life for your fiction. What's the process like of making those memories distant enough to fictionalize? Usually, the characters and the situation are far removed, and what I use of mine are details or hobbies or interests that immediately makes me feel close to those people. If I have a character remembering something in third grade, I can give them to my third grade teacher or class. I'm a big believer in emotional truth, and that's what we bring to the page. Flannery O'Connor, as controversial as she is these days and as mean as she could be, I've always really admired her whole thing about how you sort of got all you need emotionally as a writer by the time you're a teenager. I think that's really true. We know what everything feels like. We know anger, love, grief. I've always encouraged my students to really reach back and reconnect with those primal emotions. When you first recognize and know all these things in their purest form, then you transpose that onto your character. So once again, Jill McCorkle and her book, Old Crimes and Other Stories, from Algonquin Books in January of 2024. And just brief little alert. Several months ago, I read an article in Indy about college athletes making endorsement money. Could they be paid as university employees? And lo and behold, Dartmouth basketball team has joined a union. That's just came out today or the day before. And you might want to be interested in that if that took you by surprise a few months ago. Now, as a final treat from your old indie reader, John Feddersen, here's almost an entire minute of our thrilling theme song. And I'll be back with you next week. We can listen to this broadcast on the podcast section at ncreadingservice.org. And so I will say farewell for now. And remember to set those clocks on Sunday morning. Bye-bye, everybody, from Indie Week.